Strange. Today's the day you can be strange and get away with it. Yeah. White Area and Resistance calling. White Area and Resistance calling. We're here. You're there, so let's go. I see the SPLC, the Southern Millionaires Club, has put a list of 15 new targets out that they're after. And guess what? They're all people who have challenged the Muslims coming into this country, or doing what they do once they're here. So Morris the bisexual, homosexual, whatever, probably a little bit of both, he's run out of Klansmen to sue and take to court. He's run out of all these other people. They're just not doing enough. So he's now launching against people who criticize Muslims. He's found himself a new field to endeavor. Well, the big elephant in the living room, of course, is the military spending in this country. They'll drag you off on a million different tangents, but they don't want to talk about the military spending in this country. Nearly $1 trillion a year. Yeah, that's a trillion with a capital T. If you want to know why your infrastructure is falling apart and nothing's being done about it, do you hear either candidate talking about backing way off on the military-industrial budget, the war budget? Do you hear them talking about closing down bases around the world where we've got, I guess, 500 bases? Do they ever talk about that? No, they talk about spending more and more and more money. The weapons are just too antiquated. Maybe they're only a couple of years old, and we spent a fortune on it, but they need more. So why doesn't Hillary and Donald talk about this? Cut that damn war budget in half. I haven't heard very many liberals talk about it. But conservatives, boy, they're convinced to spend more money. You'll just spend more money on arms and occupy more countries to supposedly bring them peace. Everything's going to be wonderful, but everywhere we go to do all those fine things, it turns around, it works just the opposite. Just the opposite. I picked up a little speech from, I'm not sure whether he was an Iraqi or what, speaking to a British audience. Let me find it here. Well, I can't find it right now. I'll probably play it for you later. But I will play another one, who will weed out the warmongers. If Hillary hangs on to win the presidency, liberal Democrats have vowed to block her appointment of Wall Street-friendly officials to key cabinet and other sub-cabinet posts. But there has been little organized resistance to her choosing hawkish foreign policy advisors. Indeed, Washington's foreign policy establishment has purged almost anyone who isn't part of the neoconservative liberal interventionist group think, and that's pretty much everyone who matters agrees about the need to push around Russia, China, Syria, Iran, and so on. Reflecting that attitude, Sunday's lead editorial in the neocon Washington Post hailed the broad consensus with the establishment for more warlike actions once President Obama is gone, taking with him what the Post calls Obama's self-defeating passivity. The Post praised a new report from the Liberal Center for American Progress, which calls for bombing the Syrian military and getting tough to counter Iran's negative influence, in line with what all the neocons, as well as Israel and Saudi Arabia, want their next president to do. The absence of any significant counter to this neocon liberal war hawk groupthink represents one of the greatest dangers to the future of the human species, since this new hubris comes with a cavalier assumption that nuclear-armed Russia and China will simply accept humiliation dished out by the indispensable nation. If they don't, we can expect official Washington to ratchet up tensions in a game of nuclear chicken with the expectation that the leaders of Moscow and Beijing will bow down to the U.S. exceptionalism and sink away with their tails between their legs. Surely, That is what the armchair warriors at the Washington Post will demand, and they have, of course, a spotless record of infallibility, such as they were certain that Iraq was hiding stockpiles of WMD in 2003. Editorial page editor Fred Hyatt was so sure of that he wrote it as a flat fact. Given the Iraqi war catastrophe and the failure to find the WMDs, you might have assumed that Hyatt was summarily fired and was never worked as journalist again. But of course, you'd be wrong. He's still the editorial page editor of the Washington Post, continuing to ladle out his extraordinary wisdom and brilliant insights. And if you dare question these new certainties or note the risks of stumbling into a nuclear conflagration, the Post editorial pages label you a Moscow stooge, repeating Russian propaganda. That is what the Post columnist Ann Applebaum wrote about the Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump when he warned about the risk of a World War III if a President Hillary Clinton starts shooting down Russian planes over Syria. Rather than acknowledge the genuine risk of getting into a shooting war with Russia, neocon Applebaum declares such concerns as unacceptable and offers a whiff of McCarthyism toward anyone who thinks in such a way. Quote, "Why is the Russian state media using such extreme language?" unquote, she asked darkly. Quote, "And why is Trump repeating it?" Then, with the typical perceptiveness of a neocon ideologue, Applebaum determines that the Kremlin is warning its citizens of growing risks of nuclear war to scare them into line amid a recession that the U.S. helped create as part of its regime change strategy to destabilize Russia by making its economy scream. A thoughtful person might stop here and wonder if the use of economic sanctions and other means to destabilize nuclear-armed Russia is such a good idea. But no mainstream person is allowed to raise such questions inside the official Washington. That would just make you a Russian puppet, in Applebaum's view. Applebaum then rants on with some wild conspiracy theories about the Russian plans to exploit the U.S. presidential transition. Quote, "Whatever the outcome of the November 8th political uncertainty will follow. The months of transition, a change of White House staff, perhaps even a violent backlash that the Trump may incite, this could be an excellent moment for a major Russian offensive, a land grab in the Ukraine, a foray into the Baltic states, a much bigger intervention in the Middle East, anything to test the new president. If that's coming, Putin needs to prepare his public to fight much bigger wars and to persuade the rest of the world not to stop him. He needs to get his generals into the right mindset and his soldiers ready to go. A little nuclear war rhetoric never fails to focus attention, and I'm sure it has." Perhaps the more immediate question is why the major American newspapers run such crazy and reckless drivel from one of its regular columnists. But the fact that the Post Office so indicates how dangerous the moment is for humanity. For those of us who read the Post regularly, such insane rhetoric barely registered, since we see similar nuttiness on a daily basis. But the groupthink that the Post and other mainstream publications create and then enforce explains why there is such unity among the establishment as it presses ahead with these dangerous policies in much the same manner that almost same cast of other insiders group thought their way into the disastrous Iraqi war. In other words, the media is moving us towards war all the time. And neither candidate seriously talking about cutting our arms production. And they've got a bunch of excuses for it, like they got these plants all over the United States, and there's a lot of jobs would be lost. But what is that compared to a possible nuclear war? Listen to this kid in a British audience who thinks he knows it all and wants to be an interventionist. Listen to what he's saying and listen to the reply by someone with a few more brains. Yeah.
Mr. Galloway, I would like to pick you up on 2 points. Firstly, you claim that you do not wish to see the Middle East ruled by tyrants, but you have filmed hugging Saddam Hussein. And secondly, your obsession with not deploying military assets leads to bloodshed. If we had done nothing in Libya, Benghazi would be a bloodbath. Us doing nothing in Syria has led Syria to be a bloodbath. But your obsession with imperialism when people cry out for help surely is wrong. Surely we have to listen to the people who want our help, who need our help for the very freedoms you advocate, instead of branding ourselves imperialism over historical guilt.
They obviously heard you better than I did. Perhaps it's my age. I didn't grasp much of that. They obviously heard you better than I did. Perhaps it's my age. I didn't grasp much of that. I heard it punctuated by well-known names and places. So I shall do my best to infer what it was that you were saying. The Gaddafi dictatorship in Libya was a joke. They had 2 million people, an ocean of oil and gas, revenues of trillions of dollars, such that every Libyan person should have been a multi-millionaire, and the public realm in Libya should have looked like Dubai. But anybody who has ever been in Libya knows that that was not true. Now, I've never met Gaddafi or any of his family. I think you might be confusing me with Tony Blair. I've never met Gaddafi or any of his family, and I have nothing whatsoever to do with the former regime in Libya. But I will say this to you, it takes a particular genius to make Libya worse than it was under Gaddafi. And that's what we have now done. If you don't believe me, take a look at the pictures of the black people twisting like strange fruit from the trees in the wind, hanged and lynched by the so-called rebels, revolutionaries now in power in Libya. Or take a look at the US embassy compound in Benghazi, where Al-Qaeda murdered the American ambassador just a year ago. Or take a look at the fancy hotel in downtown Tripoli, from which at 4 o'clock in the morning, just last week, the Prime Minister of Libya was kidnapped at gunpoint by hundreds of people and had to be rescued by hundreds of other people at gunpoint and taken to one of their houses and interrogated. Take a look at the fact that Libya was once one country and is now God knows how many countries, such that the son of the dictator, Mr. Blair's best friend, Mr. Blair, helped him write his thesis for his PhD from the Libyan School of the London School of Economics. Mr. Mandelson was a big pal of his too. Was, I stress. Hasn't done much to help him in his current Calvary. Where is that Calvary? It's in Zintan, in a dungeon, from which they will not release him. Never mind to the International Criminal Court, which demands his prisons to face charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity, but will not release him to Tripoli to stand trial in the capital of the country. Insists on torturing him and trying him themselves. They've already cut off two of his fingers and knocked out most of his teeth. Libya is a totally non-functioning state. It was pretty bad under Gaddafi. It's now even worse. And how you could stand up in the Oxford Union and pray in aid the success of imperialist intervention in Libya, well, you're not watching the same news bulletins as me. I heard you mention the Iraqi dictatorship, as was. The imperialist intervention in Iraq, I thought, had no sentient being left in the land speaking up for it, but I was wrong. Here in the Oxford Union, if I'm inferring what you said properly, we have one. Well, you're the last man standing that thinks killing 1 million people in Iraq, driving 3 million Iraqis out of their country as refugees, breaking Iraq from one country into dozens of countries, each of them ruled by sectarian militia, the making of Iran, our former, now current, bogeyman of the day, the most powerful element in Iraqi state and political affairs. Anybody who thinks that as a success is a success story is not living in the same land as me. Anybody who thinks that by invading and occupying Iraq, generating extremism amongst that 2 billion Muslims of which I talked, to the extent that it has cascaded everywhere in the world, has multiplied Al-Qaeda and its mindset everywhere, anybody who thinks that is a success, well, I despair. If you're really an Oxford student and you think that the imperialist invasion and occupation of Iraq is any kind of success story, I really can't imagine how you reached that conclusion. Certainly the parents of the soldiers who were sent there on a pack of lies, this is an important component of the collapse in credibility of our political class, and which my film will deal with in detail. You see, it's not just that the invasion of Iraq was a crime. It's not just that it was a blunder, though crime and blunder it clearly was. It's that it was all done on a pack of lies. A false, fake casus belli was constructed and then exposed in front of the entire world. So, there are small tyrants and there are big tyrants. If I may quote from St. Augustine's book, City of God, in which he tells of the encounter on the high seas between Alexander the Great, as he called himself, and a pirate captain. Ordering the pirate ship to halt, Alexander demands of the captain, "How dare you terrorize these waters as a thief?" And the captain answers back, "How dare you terrorize the entire world? You with your great navy can call yourself an emperor and can call other men as you please." That's the world we had then and have now. That Blair and Bush can call other men tyrants, dictators, rogue states, failed states, states that have to be invaded and occupied. I finished the answer to this with how I started. Did you imagine that the Iraqis would respond to the invasion and occupation of their country any differently to how we would have responded if Hitler had invaded and occupied us? If you did, that means you think Iraqis are less than us. I know that that's not true.
I ran across a speech, I'm not sure when it was made, by Mr. Wendell Berry, talking about Agriculture USA. You know, we're talking to each other all the time about, in an emergency, what we would do, and we would be growing our own food and all that kind of stuff. Well, any kind of collapse along those lines, the first thing that would happen would be the supermarkets would be emptied out in 24 hours. There would be virtually nothing left in any grocery store or supermarket. Then they would, hordes of people would go through the countryside looking for any way they can get food. And if you have done your duty and raised quite a bit of food, it's not going to help you out because these roving bands of people would take it and kill you. So that's something most Americans don't think about or don't talk about. That is a very distinct possibility in very few years to happen, the way things are going. So I'm going to play this speech. I think it was made clear back in the 50s, but he sure nailed the tail on the donkey, I'll tell you that. And don't ever forget it. It's entitled, Where the Food Comes From.
Out here, I said I wouldn't have time to prepare a speech, but I largely underestimated the travel time between Kentucky and Spokane. The speech is not filled out. It sort of gives the structure of my thinking about the problems that I've observed in agriculture. I was asked to talk about labor-intensive microsystems agriculture. That's not my language, and it's not the sort of language that I wish to use, because it's the way people speak when they don't want to be understood by most people. I'm not sure what to make of these particular phrases, but they seem to me to suggest merely a methodological or technological approach to agriculture. And part of my purpose here is to suggest that any such approach will necessarily be too simple. I should perhaps say something about my qualifications. I'm not a farm expert, and I wasn't educated in an agriculture college. I do come from a farm community where my people have farmed for five or six generations before me, and where I farm, and I inherit from my father and others concern for what happens to farmers. And I won't speak mainly out of my experience. In my boyhood, Henry County, Kentucky was not just a rural county, as it still is. It was almost entirely a farming county. Farms were generally small. They were farmed by families who lived not only upon them, but within and from them. They grew gardens. They produced their own meat, milk, and eggs. They were highly diversified. The main money crop was tobacco. But the farmers also grew corn, wheat. I feel like I'm talking in a barrel. Do I need to move this thing back or something? Well, that's a paradoxical remedy. But the farmers also grew corn, wheat, barley, and oats, sorghum and hay for forage. Cattle, hogs, and sheep were all characteristically raised in association on the same farms. There were many small dairies, the milking more often than not done by hand. Those were the farm products that might have been considered major. But there were also minor products, and one of the most important characteristics of that old economy was the existence of markets for those minor products. In those days, a farm family could easily market its surplus of cream, eggs, old hens, and frying chickens. The major motive power for field work was still furnished by horses and mules. There was still a prevalent pride in workmanship, and thrift was still a social ideal. The pride of most people was still in their homes, and their homes looked like it. This was by no means a perfect society. Its people had often been violent and wasteful in their use of the land and of each other. Its present ills had already taken root in it. But I have spoken of its agricultural economy of a generation ago to suggest that there were also good qualities indigenous to it that might have been cultivated and built upon. That they were not cultivated and built upon, that they were repudiated as the stuff of a hopelessly outmoded, unscientific way of life, is a tragic error on the part of the people themselves. And it is a work of monstrous ignorance and irresponsibility on the part of the experts and politicians who have prescribed, encouraged, and applauded the disintegration of such farming communities all over this country into our allegedly miraculous modern American agriculture. In the decades since World War II, the farms of Henry County have become increasingly mechanized. Though they are still comparatively diversified, they are less diversified than they used to be. The holdings are larger, the owners are fewer. The land is falling more and more into the hands of speculators and professional people from the cities, who, in spite of all the scientific agricultural miracles, still have much more money than farmers. There are not nearly enough people on the farms to maintain them properly, and they are for the most part visibly deteriorating. The number of part-time farmers and ex-farmers increases every year. Our harvests depend more and more upon the labor of old men and little boys. The farm people live less and less upon their own produce, more and more from the grocery stores. The best of them are more worried about money and more overworked than ever before. Among the people as a whole, the focus of interest has largely shifted from the household to the automobile. The ideals of workmanship and thrift have been replaced by the goals of leisure, comfort, and entertainment. For, as my friend Maurice Tallien says, this nation has created the world's first broad-based hedonism. And nowhere that I know is there a market for a hen or a bucket of cream or a few dozen eggs. Those markets were done away with in the name, I believe, of sanitation, but to the enormous enrichment of the large producers. Future historians will no doubt remark upon the inevitable association with us between sanitation and filthy lucre. It is, of course, one of the miracles of science that the germs that used to be in our food have been replaced by poison. In all this, few people whose testimony would have mattered have seen the connection between the modernization of agricultural techniques and the disintegration of the culture and the communities of farming. What we have called agricultural progress has, in fact, involved the forcible displacement of millions of people. I remember during the 50s, the outrage with which certain of our leaders spoke of the forced removal of the populations of villages in communist countries. I also remember that at the same time in Washington, the word on farming was get big or get out, a policy that is still in effect. The only difference here is in method. The force used by the communists was military. With us, it has been economic, a free market in which the freest were the richest. The attitudes were equally cruel, and I believe that in the long run the results will be equally damaging, not just to the concerns and values of the human spirit, but to the practical possibilities of survival. And so those who could not get big have got out, not just in my community, but in farm communities all over the country. Bigness, however, is a most amorphous and unstable category. As a social or economic goal, it is totalitarian. It establishes an inevitable tendency toward the tyrannical one that will be the biggest of all. Many who got big to stay in are now being driven out by those who are still bigger. The aim of bigness implies not one social or cultural aim that is not noxious. Its influence on us may already have been disastrous, and we have not yet seen the worst. And this community-killing agriculture with its monomania of bigness is not primarily the work of farmers, though it has burgeoned upon their weaknesses. It is the work of the institutions of agriculture, the experts and the agribusinessmen who have promoted so-called efficiency at the expense of community and quality and quantity at the expense of quality. Last year in Kentucky, 1,000 dairies went out of business. And that was recognized as an acceleration of a long-established trend. They were the victims of policies by which we imported dairy products to compete with our own and exported so much grain as to cause a drastic rise in the price of feed. Typically, an agricultural expert from the University of Kentucky, my colleague, was willing to applaud the failure of 1,000 dairymen whose cause he is supposedly being paid with their money to serve. They were inefficient producers, he concluded, who needed to be eliminated. He did not say, indeed there was no indication that he had even considered, what might be the limits of his criterion or his logic. Does he propose to applaud this same process year after year until biggest and most efficient become synonymous with only? This sort of brainlessness is invariably justified by pointing to the enormous productivity of American agriculture. But any abundance, in any amount, is illusory if it does not safeguard its producers. And in American agriculture, abundance has always tended to destroy its producers. Along with the rest of society, the established agriculture has shifted its emphasis and even its interest from quality to quantity. And along with the rest of the society, it has failed to see that in the long run, quantity is inseparable from quality. To pursue quantity alone is to destroy those disciplines in the producers that are the only assurance of quantity. The preserver of abundance is excellence. What are the results of such thinking? The results are the drastic decline in farm population and in political strength. The growth of a vast, uprooted, dependent, and unhappy urban population, which, by the way, is abjectly dependent as it is on the farmer, consistently votes against him. Our rural and urban problems have largely caused each other. The result is an unimaginable waste of land, of energy, of fertility, and of human beings. The result is that the life of the land, which in its native processes is infinite, has been made totally dependent upon the finite, scarce, and expensive materials and products of industry. The result is the disuse of so-called marginal lands, potentially productive, but dependent upon intensive human care and long-term human familiarity and affection. The result is the virtual destruction of the farm culture, without which farming, in any but the exploitative or extractive sense, is impossible. My point is that food is a cultural, not a technological product. That is, I'm saying that culture is a larger category than technology and includes technology. A culture is not a collection of relics or ornaments, but a practical necessity, and its destruction invokes calamity. A healthy culture is a communal order of memory, insight, value, and aspiration. It would reveal the human necessities and the human limits. It would clarify our inescapable bonds to the earth and to each other. It would assure that the necessary restraints be observed, that the necessary work be done, and that it be done well. A healthy farm culture can only be based upon familiarity. It can only grow among a people soundly established upon the land. It would nourish and protect the human intelligence of the land that no amount of technology can satisfactorily replace. The growth of such a culture was once a strong possibility in the farm communities of this country. We now have only the sad remnants of that possibility, as we now have only the sad remnants of those communities. If we allow another generation to pass without doing what is necessary to enhance and embolden that possibility, we will lose it altogether. And then we will not only invoke calamity, we will deserve it. Several years ago, I argued with a friend of mine that we might make money by going ahead and marketing some inferior lambs. My friend thought about this for a minute, and then he said, "I'm in the business of producing good lambs, and I'm not going to sell any other kind." He also said that he kept the weeds out of his crops for the same reason that he washed his face. Surely no one would question that the human race has survived by that attitude. It still survives by that attitude, though now it can hardly be said to know it, much less acknowledge it. But this attitude does not come from technique or technology. It does not come from education. In more than two decades in universities, I have rarely seen it. It does not come even from principle. It comes from a passion that is culturally prepared, a passion for excellence and order that is characteristically, that may be exclusively, handed down to young people by older people whom they respect and love. When we destroy the possibility of that succession, we will have gone far toward destroying ourselves.
Well, that quality might not have been perfect, but I hope you can understand it. I even had a glitch there for a few seconds that I was off. So anyhow, I hope you get it. But in the nutshell, that's what's happening. I see it around here in all this agriculture here in Indiana. They're pouring more and more and more chemicals on these crops. One of them you've heard of probably is Roundup. Every hardware, every store where there's any agricultural products I go into, you see rows and rows of Roundup, this toxic insecticide that they're dumping all over the land and destroying the land. Land can wear out. Southern farmers found that when they planted too much and too often cotton. It wear out the land. And so, you know, the time may come when you can't even go to the country and get food because there'll be no food there. And the other thing is we're producing massive amounts of crops to send overseas to other countries that don't seem to know how to raise their own food. Now, that's going to catch up sooner or later, too. Now, the farmers think that's a good deal, and that's what keeps them going, but it's not. I notice my lady has pretty bad, really bad allergies. And I never had allergies in California. Can't remember. But now I do. And sneezing and so forth. And when they harvest the corn in a field about a block away, maybe a couple of blocks away from my house, the sneezing goes up. It's not, with me, it's not extreme, but my lady has to take more and more so-called over-the-counter medicine, or takes it, I don't know. But anyhow, the point is that our agricultural system's going to break down someday. And once it breaks down, it's going to be hell to pay because it would take a long time to bring it back. So that's why I'm playing this for you. You're thinking about going out and buying all kinds of guns to confront the naggers. You better think about other things too, about how to put food away and how to can food and all that kind of stuff. When I was a kid, we used to can everything. Meat, vegetables, you name it. Even chicken. And that way, in the middle of the winter, when we couldn't get any food out of the field or out of the barn, we had food. We always had food. So, okay, I hope this is a wise comment that you're going to take to heart and consider that your neighbor farmer, who may be your best buddy, is shipping tremendous amounts of food overseas to the black holes of the world without any concern about the future of the feeding our own people. Think about it. Because when and if a breakdown comes, the walking dead will be a reality, because you know how a bulk of the people will react. And when they don't have food, you'll know how they'll react. And they'll be worse than the walking dead. Don't expect your leaders, so-called leaders, to help you. They're not even helping you now. Do you ever hear of Team Blue? One of our she-wolves sent me this article from New York called Team Blue, 10 Haitian Finest Return to Aid Recovery. Now, these are guys that are New York Police Department officers. They come here as so-called immigrants or invaders. And now here they're referred to not New York City's finest, which I think that's good in a way, but still, they're going back to Haiti to help the Haitian people. It shows them a picture of them, and they're the scrubbiest, dumbest looking bunch of niggers I ever seen. And they show a picture of a neighborhood in Haiti, which Haiti's a total failed safe state. And I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. Ever since the French left, that was clear back at the beginning of our country, the French bailed. And when you take a look at Haiti, you'll know why. I mean, you know, these people can't take care of themselves. So they become a plague on our country. But Hillary Clinton loves them. She could put a camera in the face of these scrawny, ill-fed kids and extract millions out of the dummies here in this country. Millions of these people, you can't do anything for them. There's no way. Unless you rob other people that are in better shape and who have worked harder for what they've got and give it to these people. So now we're sending, well, I wish they'd send them down there and leave them down there. Because if you could see this picture of these New York PD Haitian cops, you'd say, hey, take them back, Haiti. We'll even pay you to take them back. I get quite a bit of notes from you people, and I try to answer them as much as I can. Here's one fellow says, you know, Tom, we're in a precarious situation. That's for sure. And I sometimes email you with questions. I know you're busy, but I feel that I'm in a very desperate and dangerous situation, ready to blow, and can really use some advice when I email you, being a long-time war supporter. But I feel I do in most cases. If I don't answer within a week or so, send it again, because sometimes things get lost in the shuffle. I try to answer every question I'm sent. I think I cover a tremendous amount of questions in our programs, because we talk about everything under the sun all the time. So sometimes I don't think some people are hearing and listening to all the radio shows, so they don't get the information. Because you never know which show and which day you're going to get an answer to your question. But if you got a question, just send it to me and I'll do my best to answer it. But sometimes people want to ask questions there's no way anybody can answer, you know. This is a note I received where there's that article about the Haitian Negroes that are New York City's finest Haitians going back to Haiti to help the Haitian people. Well, that, which I told you already, that's a waste of time. Here is an article in the New York Daily News about Haitian police officers in New York PD taking a leave of absence to go down to Haiti to help with the rescue mission. If they feel that way about it, then why don't they resign from the New York City Police Department and go back to Haiti? The sorry part is the chief of the department is granting them leaves so they can go down on a, quote, humanitarian effort. This is being paid for by the New York Police Department, actually by the taxpayers, and the city of New York. It is the same old story. The white man and the Christian dupes have to save these people who would turn around and kill us, and we are paying for it. Can you imagine if you had you had some pro-white New York City cops saying we want to leave in of absence to go to Europe and stop the Muslims from invading and lock up Muslims or yet just kill them then for assaults and mass rapes they're committing over there? They would be fired for racism. The bottom line is this. We don't owe non-whites a thing. We're in competition with other races, and we should only feed and give aid to our kind. Yours truly, Lone Wolf, New York City. Well, that's for sure. Thanks for that note. Well, the fact is, as far as I can see, that well over half of our race, maybe two-thirds, have gone completely insane. They bought into all the equality myths. They've bought into all the myths that are being spread by the race mixers to justify everything. And they still, even when a lot of our people are on the ropes, these people are still yelling to give more, more, more. And you know, if Hillary gets in, it'll be 10 times worse. I don't know what would happen if Donald Trump gets in because he's not been in there. But I don't trust him either. That makes some people a little unhappy, but that's just the way it is. Anybody that's got power and money, I don't trust them. Don't trust them at all. If they happen to do right, that's nice. I'm all for it. But don't expect it. But we know what Hillary will do. She'll be borrowing more and more money from China to fight more and more wars and also to give away through all kinds of programs to our non-white enemies. Well, the Israel IDF military is in a panic about the Russian military's presence and deployment of sophisticated weaponry in the region, Israel's Channel 2 reported on Sunday. According to the report, though, the IDF is not admitting this openly. High-ranking officers have said behind closed doors that the surprising quality and quantity of Russian systems in the area is dramatically hampered the way the Israeli Air Force and the Navy are able to operate. Both these branches of the IDF, according to Channel 2, were used to flying and sailing wherever and whenever they saw fit, with no real threat to their movement. But since Russia began to intervene in the Syria civil war last year in an attempt to protect the regime of President Bashar Assad, things have changed. One particular worry, the report said, was the impending arrival of Admiral Kuznetsov, Russia's flagship aircraft carrier, which is on its way from the North Sea to the Middle East and is expected to anchor off the Mediterranean coast of Syria in the coming weeks. The Kuznetsov ship is made up of some 1,900 Russian sailors, more than 50 advanced fighter jets, the latest aeronautical defense systems, radars, and among the world's best electronic warfare capabilities. The force has anti-submarine capabilities and boats with a wide range of missiles for aerial photography and intelligence gathering. The report said Israel's defense officials admit that the Russians know about every moment Israel makes in at sea or sea space, as there is no way to elude Russian radars, and thus Russia has been able to collect massive amounts of information. Wow. As was reported by the Al Jazeera in April, the Russians announced several months ago that they were leaving Syria. Since then, however, according to Channel 2, they have been dispatching more ground troops to the area. They have increased their air power and they have brought in ground-to-air missiles with a range of more than 200 miles, kilometers, and are capable of employing cruise and ballistic missiles, planes, and drones. At present, they are also reinforcing their naval presence in the eastern Mediterranean in parallel with a decrease in the presence of the U.S. Navy there. And also I was watching last night about the United States Pentagon involving itself in Africa, which is, we're up to our ass in Africa now. We have drone bases all over Africa. I mean hundreds of them. And you're going to see a lot of your young men be going to Africa now instead of going to a lot of these other places. But then there are going to be a lot of more of them going to Asia. So, it's going to be lots of fun. And if you put this homicidal maniac Hillary in it, it's going to be really fun. I mean, Donald Trump might do the same thing, but I don't know. I see that Polish soccer fans have been setting fire to Jewish effigies, unfurl anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish banner calling for the burning of Jews at their football games. A legendary baseball player, mulling a run for the U.S. Senate on the Republican ticket, asked his interviewer on Friday why Jews support Democrats. CNN reported, during an appearance on CNN's The Lead, former Boston Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling posed this question to host Jake Tapper, who is Jewish, after being questioned about his support for the Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump in spite of the candidate's purportedly offensive comments about women. Instead of responding to Tapper's query, Schilling, who announced plans to contend against incumbent Democrat Senator from Massachusetts Elizabeth Warren in 2018, said, I would like to ask you something as a person who is practicing the Jewish faith and has since you were young. I don't understand, and maybe this is the amateur non-politician in me. I don't understand how people of Jewish faith can back the Democratic Party, which over the last 50 years has been so clearly anti-Israel, so clearly anti-Jewish Israel. I don't know what else would need to be done, said, or happened for people to understand that. The Democratic Party is only aligned with Israel because we have agreements in place that make them have to be. Tapper replied that though he does not speak for the Jews, he would imagine that one of the reasons many Jews are Democrats has more to do with Democrats' support of social welfare programs and that sort of thing than it does for Israel. And I know that a lot of Jews who are strong supporters of Israel do support Republican Party. Let me see if I can bring up the audio on this.
practicing the Jewish faith and has since you were young. I don't understand how people of Jewish faith can back the Democratic Party, which over the last 50 years has been so clearly anti-Israel.
Well, I don't speak for Jews, and I don't support the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. I would imagine, just to try to answer your question, that one of the reasons many Jews are Democrats has more to do with Democrats' support for social welfare programs.
Talk about an oversimplification. I'm glad he asked that question. Well, there you go, boys and girls. We had a couple of glitches there in the show, but I hope you could stick with me. I'll try to recover. I'll be back tomorrow on Tuesday about that. Just remember, when the maddening throng comes down on the grocery stores in an emergency, you white people will not have anything to eat. And then you might learn you have to kill. You know, you forgot about that, survival. Well, you better relearn it.
I'm in a position to know, because the Patrick Henry Society has studied the whole thing. The real problem, whether you like it or not, is whether you're going to sit back and let desegregation spread throughout the entire South. And it's an indisputable fact that there could be no other result. The Negroes will literally, and I do mean literally, control the South. The vote will be theirs. You'll have black mayors and black policemen the way they do in Chicago and New York already. Like is not a black governor and black doctors to deliver your babies. If they find time, that is. And that's the way it'll be. Did you ever stop to think about that? When you let those 10 enter your school, did you?
Well, most people didn't know it, but Bill Shatner did. William Shatner knew all about it. He predicted it perfectly.